So why I say, sorry, emergent photons. So why do I say emergent? So when we discussed the Z2 lattice gauge theory, we saw that we do not need to introduce, by ad hoc, a gauge invariant Hilbert space and gauge fields, but that all these structures emerge from considering the low energy effective theory of a model that can be described in terms of strings. So we saw that we have a total Hilbert space in which is spanned by all the possible spin configurations, but then we have the Hilbert space of closed loops, and closed loops are always gauge invariant quantities. So the Hilbert space of the closed loops is identical with the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So if we just consider the low energy theory, that is the one on the loops, then we have the Z2 gauge theory emerge. So we want to do something similar here. So first of all, we want to understand what is a lattice U1 gauge theory. And to do this, we will first define it in a classical model. Then we will do the time continuum formulation to find the quantum Hamiltonian. And this quantum Hamiltonian is defined again on a gauge invariant Hilbert space, but then we would like to show that this gauge invariant Hilbert space is nothing else but the Hilbert space of a string net theory. And that the effective theory in this string net theory is ordinary electromagnetism. So that from just a spin model, we have emergent photons as elementary excitations of this model. OK. So in order to get a U1 gauge theory, we need now some continuous variable, right? We cannot have just a finite spin that is just two values. So if you remember our discussion of the ICU model, we must first understand how we can make a icing model with continuous variables, which would have only a, so an icing, let me put it by quotes, model would have a global U1 symmetry. And then we must find a method to promote the symmetry to a local one, local U1, just like we did with the icing model, okay? So what can we do? So imagine that, so we will always use a hypercubic lattice. So let me show a plaquette here. And imagine that we put some angular variable on the sides of this lattice. So this could be theta of n. This could be theta of n plus mu. This could be theta of n plus mu plus nu. And this theta of n plus nu. Okay, so I'm labeling this vector as mu and this vector as nu. And then it's the site. And I can define a planar spin, like the vector cosine theta at n, so the planar spin at n, sine theta at n. Okay, so this is just a degree of freedom that lives on the sides, and is telling me where in this plane our spin is oriented. Okay, and then I can write an energy that is the typical form. So I sum over all the sides and over all the directions, and I couple Sn with Sn plus mu. This is scalar product. Well, so if I do the scalar product, this is of course the sum of cosine theta n times cosine. Okay, so let me just write. And similarly for the sine. And I can write this like the cosine of theta n plus mu minus theta n. Yep. No, no, I'm summing over all the possible values of mu. So in this case, nu, I've chosen y, and mu, I've chosen x. But if I put in here, it means that it's not a fixed value, right? It has to run. Okay. Now I can define a finite difference operator that I just call delta mu. So delta mu on theta n is defined in this way, so by definition. So it just gives me the difference between theta n plus mu minus theta n. Okay, so obviously this is, I can write this action like just the sum over delta mu theta n. Well, so now you see that if I do a global U1 transformation, so this means that every theta n goes in theta n plus a common angle for all of them chi, then delta mu theta n goes into itself, and therefore this action has a global U1 symmetry. Okay? So also notice that this U1 transformation is a compact U1 group because these are angles. So we are assuming that theta plus 2 pi is again theta, which is, and our action is compatible with this request because we are taking the cosine. Okay? So the fact that it's compact will play a very important role in the following. Okay, so this is a global, this is just the planar model. Okay, so also these models has interesting phase transitions, but we do not have the time to talk about this. But now we want to promote our global U1 to some local U1. Okay, so from the cosine of what?
On the right-hand side of the equation, they've got the sum of
oh, the cosine. Yeah, no, no, but simply because I forgot. So all that looks missing is because it's missing. Okay. So anyways, if delta mu is invariant, detection is invariant. Okay, so we want to promote to a local U1 symmetry. Okay, so the trick is always to start with a model where we place our degrees of freedom on the links. Remember, this is what we did also for the Z2 theory. So now let me label again all these sites. So this will be the site n, this is n plus mu, this is n plus mu, and this is n plus mu plus mu. And now I will put an angular variable on the link, and I will call it theta mu n. Okay? So to label this link, I have to use a starting point and the direction. So I can call it theta mu n. Well, of course, I could also start from here and go in this other direction. So I could also place a variable on this link by calling it theta minus mu starting from n plus mu. So we must make some choice. So we must decide whether these links are oriented or not. So if I put equal here, then they would be not oriented. But if I put a minus, they would be oriented. And I make this choice, because you will see what happens with this choice. It's a very convenient choice. So this is theta mu n. This will be theta nu, starting from n plus mu. This one here is theta minus mu, starting from n plus mu plus nu. And this last one is theta minus nu, starting at 10 plus nu. Or I could call it, this link here could be theta in the new direction starting from n. Okay. So we have just put names, right? The only thing is that we have decided to put the variables on oriented links. This is the only part that has an actual content. Okay, so now let me define a discrete version of the curl operator. So discrete curl. So the discrete curl, well, we take our discrete differential operator and we apply it to, in this way. Yep.
Isn't the link on the top, isn't the top link oriented in the opposite direction from the bottom link?
Sorry?
Isn't it oriented in the way you, if you define it like that, isn't the top link oriented in the opposite direction?
So this is the one where I am going in this direction.
Yeah.
Like this. Yeah.
Okay. It's supposed to.
So it says it here, minus mu.
Yeah.
Okay. So this would be minus the same variable if I start from here.
Yeah.
Okay. So now let's just apply our definition of what is delta mu here. Okay. So I have defined a curl. This is what I've done here. And so what is this? This will be theta nu at n plus mu minus theta nu at n minus theta mu at n plus nu plus theta mu at n. Okay? So now let me use my relations between the things here. So what I find is that, so let me start from this one. This, I just write it like theta mu n. So it's this. So I'm starting from here, and I want to move in this direction. Okay. So I want to show what happens. So if I start from here and we move in this direction, I first get to this link, that is theta mu n. Then I have plus, theta at n plus mu in the direction nu. So it's this other term here. Well, then I have minus theta mu n plus nu. But this is equal to plus theta minus mu at n plus mu plus nu, right? Because of our definition, which is exactly what I wrote here. It's this link when I'm moving in this direction. And then finally, the last one, this becomes plus theta at n plus mu, and then I go down. So this means that our curl is what I get if I do a plaquette operator moving in this direction. See, I start, I sum this plus this plus this plus this. So it's a plaquette operator. And now we need to define some local gauge transformation. So our local gauge transformation is obtained by taking one of our variables and adding some angle, let me do like this, that depends on n. Okay? So this is the definition of our local gauge transformation. And so it is an easy check to check that under this gauge transformation, our curve goes into itself. And the reason basically is because these terms that have the minus mu, they transform adding plus chi n instead of subtracting it. And therefore they all cancel. Okay. Well, so in order to make this gauge transformation look more familiar, because I am allowed to make a gauge transformation at every point, so I would say that a local gauge transformation is obtained by making, because these are link variables, I will always, a gauge transformation on the link is obtained by making a gauge transformation at every side, at the two sides that are shared by that link. So I can just write like this, plus another chi that is at n plus mu. Okay, but again, you can just imagine that I've done two of the original gauge transformations in a row. So again, theta mu nu is invalid. Okay. So now we need to choose some action, some energy that contains this gauge invariant quantities. And what we choose is, okay, well, we want a U1, a compact U1 gauge theory. So that's why we will take the cosine of theta. And just for convenience, I will put a constant here because I will use it in a second. So, and then I sum over all the possible sides and in all the possible directions in my lattice. Okay, so this is the action for the local U1 gauge theory. Oh, and I forgot to put minus J, the coupling constant. So first I want to show you that there are some resemblances already with what happens in electrodynamics. In fact, we can write this as this gauge transformation. If you see, this is equal to theta mu plus delta mu chi. By our definition of this delta mu. So this resembles what happens when we have our vector potential in mu and we add a total derivative of some function. And f, theta mu going in theta mu resembles f mu going into itself. Now we want to make this connection a little bit more stringent. So, and now let's try to understand what would be of this model at very low temperatures, or which is the same because the coupling constant, as we learned, is like a it's like an inverse temperature. So low T, which is like large J. So for large J, your theta should be very small, right? Or I pay too much of energy. And also it's not varying very much. It's a slow variable. Well, this means that I can approximate the cosine in this way. And now you see the power action looks like the sum of some f min u squared terms, or some density. Okay. Well, so now what we want to do is to do the mapping from classical to quantum. And so in the Ising case, we saw that what we have to do is to write this action with an isotropic coupling constants in some direction that we call the temporal direction, and then the other directions. And then we take the time continuum limit. And then we try to read out from the expression that we get the transfer matrix. And this is, the log of this is some quantum Hamiltonian. So we obtain some quantum Hamiltonian with this typical recipe. So the relevant passages are that we write our action in this way. So instead now of using J, I will use two different coupling constants in the two different directions. So in the tempor, so I will call with Latin indexes, I, K, J, and so on and so forth, the special directions. And this direction will be tau on our lattice. Yeah.
Just before continuing, you said that in the low temperature regime, we can say that 1 minus cos is the angle squared. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, because at the low temperature means that you have to minimize this. Right? So theta is more. You develop. Okay, so you have minus beta tau. And now I sum. Okay, so what I have to do is to write this term, 1 minus cosine theta. And this term will be itself, nothing changes when I consider plaquettes that live on the special planes. Okay, but actually, well, we can do this thing in 4D, so that we have three special dimensions and one. So we have many different planes that are all special. But then in the temporal direction, so it's there are planes, there are plaquettes that are like this. So this means that our starting point here is some site. And when we move up, we move in the tau direction, and I call it zero. Okay? So here I will sum over all the sides and all the direction k, zero k. Okay? Because this curl has two directions. One is temporal, is zero, and the other one is spatial, is k. And by changing k, I'm changing how I rotate this plaquette that has one fixed temporal direction. Well, and then let me call beta the other coupling constant, and then I have n I k, 1 minus cosine beta I k. Okay, so now you remember a second trick that we used also in the Z2 gauge theory is that because of our freedom in doing gauge transformations, I can fix the value of the temporal links, right? And in the Z2 theory, we would call them 1. In this theory, we say that the temporal links, so these objects here, so I start from some site n, and then I move in the temporal direction, they're 0. So because of this, now our temporal plaquettes, these plaquettes here simplify, right? Because instead of being the sum of these 4 angles, they will be the sum of just the cosine of the sum of just this angle plus this angle here. So this means that this term simplifies in cosine of theta, so let me see, theta n k minus theta, and here I will have k, sorry, n plus k. Okay. No, n plus tau. Because it's the upper one. So I have this. So now you remember that to do the tau continuum formulation, what you have to do is to send the Lefty spacing in this direction to 0. So that this sum becomes some integral. In order to have everything regular, this beta has to go at the same time to infinity. So this Lefty spacing in this direction is a tau, and the Lefty spacing in this in the special direction is just a. So we want to send a tau to 0 and b tau to infinity in a way that b tau over a tau is some constant that we can call g. Okay? And then something happens here too. So let me show you in a second what happens. So if a tau is going to 0, when I sum over different tempo, so this n is moving both in the fixed tau slices that are the special ones, but it also moving from one temporal slice to another temporal slice. So the sum of different temporal slices becomes an integral because we're sending a tau to 0. So the sum over all n and k, where n is everywhere, becomes 1 over a tau, the integral in our d tau, the sum of n and k, where now n is only on the special slices at fixed tau. Okay? So if you do this, your action becomes S, then you have the integral in the tau. Then you have minus b tau over a tau. And we have, now we have this object, this cosine. Now, because this cosine, so we have the cosine of delta Kn. Sorry, not delta K, delta 0n. Right? Because I am adding tau. So it's a difference in the temporal direction. OK, so now because we know that beta must be very large, then again, this angle must be very small. So I can again approximate 1 minus cosine this like 1 half delta 0 squared. Sorry, not delta 0 squared, just 0 squared. So this means that this is equal to A. So for very small A tau, this is equal to A tau over 2 theta dot square. Where theta dot, and this is theta 0, and where theta dot is just 0 key. D over the tau theta 0 key. Yeah.
Should we multiply by A tau squared?
Yeah. This is square. Okay, so this means that here we get A squared tau over 2 theta dot square 0 k at n. And I am still summing here over all the possible special n's and spatial k's. And the second term is minus beta. I have the sum over all the spatial n, all the spatial indexes I and k. And I have 1 minus cosine theta I k. And here I have over A tau that was coming from the common integration in the tau. Okay. So I must decide what is this coupling constant when the tau is going to 0. So I can send beta to 0 at the same time in a way that, so beta goes to 0 and A tau goes to 0 in a way that beta over A tau is some other coupling constant. So let me just call it J, but it's not the same J than the initial one. Okay, so this is G, and this is J. Okay. So if you now, and so the missing steps is to compute the partition function with this action, and read out from the partition function the transfer matrix and define a quantum Hamiltonian from the transfer matrix. Okay. So this is the same standard procedure, just with a different action that you saw in the Ising model. So this will be your homework, your last homework. And to read out the quantum Hamiltonian. But you can almost guess it. And the quantum Hamiltonian, so there is, if you do this, you have that AH, so A is the disorder lattice constant, will be equal to the sum of n, k, then we have our g coupling constant. And we have some quantum operator that is going there. OK? But see, this is theta dot is the conjugate variable to our angle. So it's an angular momentum when you quantize it. So this becomes Sz Sz k n squared. So just the quantum angular momentum on this link, the link that starts at n and moves in the k spatial direction. And then you have, and here you have a minus. And then you have a minus j, the sum of n, I, k. And I have these objects. And these are like some plaquette operators, right? I can call them WP. But, or I can just rewrite this thing. I just want to remark the fact that I can always write this thing like the sum over all the possible plaquettes in all the possible special planes of some operator W. It's just a name. These are plaquette operators. Yeah.
What's the character in front of the H?
What is this?
Yeah.
This is A. So it's necessary to have everything in the right units. I could put the special lattice spacing to, because this is a lattice model, I could put it to 1 and it wouldn't appear. Okay, so this is our quantum Hamiltonian. So now we must see what is the quantum version of our gauge transformations. Well, so our gauge transformation consisted in changing locally an angle, right? Well, so, but you know, because we saw it when we discussed the very phases, but by the way, that to change an angle chi at the site n, I just have to take the exponential of, okay, then here I have some minus I, then I have the sum over all the links that come out from n, and then I have my generators of rotations, that is Sjn times some angle. And this angle may depend on n, on this. So if I want to do a local gauge transformation at every n, then I just sum over all the possible sides. This object. So this is our local gauge transformations. And so the gauge invariant Hilbert space is the set of states in my original Hilbert space. So what is the original Hilbert space? The original Hilbert space is made of basis states that are cats in which I specify for every link the last one, capital N, I specify the values of these angles. Okay, so the span of these, all the possible rotor configurations or angle configurations is H total. But our gauge by the space is the set of states in H total such that GK psi is equal to psi. So this is the U1 lattice quantum gauge theory. And it has two phases, okay, that are very interesting. So the first phase is when G over J is much greater than 1. So consider the case in which it's actually completely negligible, right? So we have to call it this term in the Hamiltonian. But Sz is an angular momentum, so it's quantized, right? It has eigenvalues 0, plus, minus 1, plus, minus 2, and so on. So the energies are quantized, and the gap is 2g. So here we have a gapped theory. And actually, this gap theory, if you compare it to the same gap theory when this is just a spin-off operator, or imagine it's, you know, this is for, so U1 is nothing else but Zn when n is very, very large, right? When you have many, many values for the spins. So you remember that the gauge invariant correlation functions in this phase follow the area law, right? So if I do some loop that has an area A, this expectation value goes like e to the minus in the ground state. Well, this means that, and you know that so you know, you don't know yet, but if I imagine that I find a way to introduce the charges for this theory, well, so if I put two charges, I will have to compute the expectation value of this object here, and if the area law is still valid, and it is, I will show you later, well, in this case, the area is just the length of the string. Okay? This means that the potential between two charges, so let me call it R, this distance, goes like R. So this is what we saw also in the Z to gauge theory, the linear confinement. This is exactly what happens in quantum chromodynamics, with the important exception that there you need more flavors, so your gauge field is non-abelian, because you need to be able to make rotations within some subspace, because you have different flavors, right? So the difference, so U1 is just a phase that you, it's a number, but if you have an internal space in which you can rotate, then you need not to put a number, but you need to use a matrix that is a rotation matrix. But now matrices do not commute. So that's why if you do, you say, instead of a continuous abelian group, in order to do rotations, when you have different colors or different flavors, you need matrices, and that becomes a non-abelian group. But if you understand this with the complications of the non-abeliannity, this is what happens in quantum chromodynamics. So it's very, you can confine in this phase the quarks. What is the other phase?
Is the confined meaning QCP topological as well?
Huh?
Is the confined meaning QCP topological as well, the nature?
Okay, so this is a very good question. So, right now, not yet. Because we have introduced by hand our gauge symmetry. Okay? So, if you don't care why you have a gauge symmetry, just assume that you have. You don't need to think of topological order. The beauty of topological order is that you can describe your gauge invariant Hilbert space like the Hilbert space of some string net configurations, where the whole theory is defined on the whole Hilbert space. So you can have the gauge structure emerge at low energies. And it turns out that theories that do this, so string net theories are topologically ordered. For instance, you have just seen that they have a degeneracy that depends on the topology of the space. So if you believe that the topological order is given by the string net picture, and this is the case because when you have a soup of many strings, then a local transformation will not change your wave function. Well, oh, but then you recognize, oh, but this is like a gauge theory. So the emergent gauge theory is topological. Okay, so what is the other phase? The other phase is when G over J is much smaller than 1. Okay, so what states do we have at low energy here? You have, so for sure, you can minimize that term if you consider the state for which sigma z k n is equal to 0 for every k in there. This is the equivalent in the Z2 gauge theory of the state with all spins up. So this is in the ground state when G is 0, right? Or for in that phase, in the low energy Hilbert space. Okay, so this is one configuration that is there. But now look what happens. Imagine that I have different sides on my lattice. So I'm drawing a few. This one. And then I draw a loop that connects them. And what I do is that with alternate signs, I raise of plus 1 or a lower of minus 1 the value of sigma z around these links. Plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, minus 1. Well, but this is, right? This is obtained by multiplying different plaquettes. So it's a gauge invariant quantity. So this has the same energy than this one. Remember that we are in this phase. So the energy is determined just by the value of the second term. So this is also, this state is also in H law. So you see that the low energy sector, and this is true for every loop configuration. So if we stick to the low energy sector, we have a lot of degeneracy in the ground state. And actually the W term, this term with cosine theta ik, is making them fluctuate. So I really have an eigenstate of the system if I make a superposition of all these states. This is what it means that we have fluctuations. So the ground state or the law, H law, is a superposition of loops. So exactly like in the Z2 picture. So I can define some loop operator, WC, that just does this job, that on every link that belongs to my contour C applies e to the minus I, then I have some sign that depends on what site I am acting on. So let me put an N here because I have to put alternate signs, and then I have my theta. So this is changing the value of sigma z. Theta on that link. Okay. So this is for a closed contour. When you have a C that is an open contour, then the end of open strings will be not commuting, so this will not be commuting with the WP. This will not be commuting with the WP, and you have charges. So now you see why you can apply this argument here, because in fact, the U1 charges are the ends of open strings, because they do not commute with the WP tag. Okay, so where is the first of all, the emergence of the U1 theory? Because, well, we are still, we have understood that H fees is the same thing than the Hilbert space of the loops. But why are we in the Hilbert space of the loops? We would like to be in the total Hilbert space and the total low energy constraint to this. Well, okay, so we need to put in the Hamiltonian a new term. So my total Hamiltonian will be the Hamiltonian of the gauge theory plus U some constraint that makes us pay, and we choose U much larger than both G and J, that makes us pay a huge penalty every time we violate the gauge constraint. So a good term is the following. We just compare sigma z in two nearby links, means links that are connected by some node. So we do sigma z at the site n in the direction mu, and we compare it with sigma z at n plus mu, that is the nearby one, in whatever direction n. We take the square. Okay? And then we sum over all the possible n and mu's. And now I've used mu and nu, but I still, I mean, this is the Hamiltonian formulation, so these are just the special directions as well. I could have. So let me just put I and k like I did before. I, k, and this is I. So you see, so this is my H constant. This is H const. And then I multiply it by, okay, let me put U in here. Okay? So you see that when I violate my gauge constraint, so I'm able to read out the difference in angle between two nearby spins. So this explicitly violates my gauge constraint, which says, oh, you know, I cannot put a local reference frame because they're all equivalent. Then I pay an energy of order U. So H law of the total theory must be equal to H of the loops, which is H physical, the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So this is how, in strict analogy with what we saw in the Z2 case, this is the emergence of the U1 theory. At low energies, without having to define gauge fields or gauge symmetries, we have the same structure. Our Hamiltonian is just the a string net Hamiltonian. We have some spins here, some angular momenta here and in the G term, and then we have this plaquette term. So let me also convince you that in the phase where G over J is much smaller than 1, we actually get electromagnetism. So whereas in the other phase, we had just SZ, and the theory was gapped. So this is not easy to prove, but you can convince yourself that in this phase, when you namely have only the second term, so not easy to prove, but it's easy to understand. You have a very degenerate state. So the ground state is the superposition of many states that have all the same expectation value of the energy. So you have you can have excitations that connect these states that are arbitrarily low in energy. So it's the analogous of spin waves, only that these are gauge fluctuations. So the excitations above the ground state of the second term are the gauge fields. So there are some gapless modes. And we would like to see if these gapless modes are really photons. And to prove this, we have to show two things. And I can only show one. is that the Hamiltonian of our theory becomes the Hamiltonian of electromagnetism. Well, you can see that we would like to identify the sigma z as the electric field. Okay, so we just make this identification that this density here becomes the density of some electric field, E squared. But now we would like that the second term becomes like a B squared, because the Hamiltonian is E squared plus B squared. Well, when is that 1 minus cosine theta can become theta squared, and then I can identify with B squared? Well, only when the J coupling is very strong. So it's the trick that we repeatedly use. So when J is much bigger than G, so except in the case, so it's consistent when the theory is gapless, then the WP part becomes cosine becomes theta squared, and we can call it B squared. So that our Hamiltonian becomes the sum of E squared plus B squared, and then I can take the continuum limit in the spatial directions, and I have the integral of E squared plus B squared, which is the Hamiltonian of electromagnetism. So the second thing that one should show, but it's long, is that, so with this you can show that the, so remember also that you here have coupling constants that have G and J. So these excitations have a speed, well, if you derive the equations of motion from here, or you just remember what are the roles that electric and epsilon and mu play in electromagnetism, then the speed should be square root of gj. So you can also prove, just because of this, that these modes have a linear dispersion. But then you have to prove that you have only two polarizations, right? That there is no longitudinal mode. And this is also true, but it's what cannot be seen so easily yet. So, but it turns out that these modes that are longitudinal propagate in the Hilbert space where you excite these constraints. So at low energy, they're absent. They've been gapped away. So in the end, you have emergent photons. One last remark is that, well, because this is a lattice theory for photons, so remember that our local degrees of freedom are just some rotors, some angle variables, which actually can be simulated with very high spins, meaning with many, many layers. And we get for free photons from it. Now, because it's a lattice Hamiltonian, we might try to argue what is the maximum speed of signals in this Hamiltonian, in this Hamiltonian model, by using our Lib-Robinson bounds. Well, that's an upper bound. So if it's loose, it's loose. If it's tight, it's a very nice thing. So we would see that our maximum speed of signals, if we apply our Lib-Robinson theorem naively, this would be the maximum, it would go like the maximum of our coupling constants that are G and J. But we only have these photons when G is much smaller than J. So this would go like J. So this number is much greater than this. So it seems that our, so it's consistent because the Liebig-Robinson bound tells you, ah, you cannot go faster than this, and your light is going much slower than this. So it's consistent, but it's very loose, right? Because if J is much greater than G, J is much greater than the average between the two. So it turns out that one can actually make improvements to the Liebig-Robinson theorem. And with these improvements, so one uses the same technique, but is more careful in counting the paths and doing other things. With improvements, the Vmax goes really like GJ. So you see that we have discovered that the speed of the emergent light must be the maximum speed of signals in this model. So, and we didn't require it. We didn't require it from the beginning, saying, "Oh, you must have a Lorentz invariance." So, in order to have Lorentz invariance, you also must have a light cone. So this is approximate because you know that you actually have exponentially suppressed tails outside the light cone. But approximately, you can show that for free, you get one of the ingredients of Lorentz invariance. So this is one of the roots to argue that also gauge, also Lorentz symmetry can be emergent. Okay. Questions?
How about isomorphism invariance?
I have no idea. So there is a model, so all I can say is that there is a model first, let me say this precisely. If we have a Lorentz invariance, we must have a light cone. Now, it's something more complicated to say, oh, because we have a light cone, we have a Lorentz invariance. That's why I just said, oh, this is probably one of the roots to have that. Regarding the diffeomorphism invariance, I don't know. So I know that there is you can make a model in which the low-lying excitations have the same properties of gravitons. What this implies on diffeomorphism invariance, I don't know.